me pones un ejemplo. Entonces, si tú no quieres hablar conmigo, dímelo para yo no llamarte ni molestarte, porque nada más quedaba tú.
Real talk, real people, real stories. The He's Jizz Podcast. Yeah! Welcome, everyone, to another He's Jizz Podcast. I'm your host and founder of the He's Just a Social Worker Movement with another amazing show for you today. But before we get started, I want to remind everyone that this platform was built because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. And this is no longer our plight, and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. You know, graphic art is a visual art. It's a form that combines imagery and designed to combine ideas, emotions, or messages through various mediums. Meet Eric Drucker. He's an acclaimed artist, graphic novelist, and social critic whose work bridges the worlds of street art, fine art, and editorial illustration. Eric's creations are included in the permanent collections of esteemed institutions such as the Whitney Museum, the Museum of Modern Art, the Brooklyn Museum, and the Library of Congress. Born and raised in New York City, he began his career as a teenager, plastering his bold and thought-provoking images across urban landscapes. Eric's drawings and posters have become iconic in the global street art movement, and his paintings are frequently featured on the covers of The New Yorker. His first book, Flood, A Novel in Pictures, won the American Book Award and established him as a pioneer in the realm of wordless graphic storytelling. This was followed by Blood Song, a graphic novel soon to be adapted in a major motion picture. Eric's reputation as a social critic has led to editorial collaborations with The Nation, The New York Times, The Progressive, and other prominent publications. He's also brought in his artistic vision to the big screen, designing animation for the film Howl, and later worked with DreamWorks Animation. Today, we talk to Eric about his new book, Naked City, a graphic novel, where he tells us and paints for us the story of three bohemians, a painter, a street dancer, and an aspiring musician. We walk with Eric as he helps us unpack Naked City. Is it possible for an artist to survive in the 21st century? Eric, welcome to our show.
Hey, it's good to be here.
Such a pleasure having you. Before we dive in, tell us a little bit about yourself. Tell me about your journey and your walk. How did you get involved into this work?
Well, it was it took a little while. You know, it didn't just happen. It took like a good 15, 20 minutes to fully, you know, develop. But so much of it had to do with being born and raised in New York City, right there on the East Side, the Lower East Side, the Tompkins Square district, which is such a crossroads. You have so many different cultures, so many different languages are spoken there, that all of that just influenced me as a little toddler. Just every time I crossed 14th Street, I'd be just seeing all of the different social contradictions just by virtue of crossing the street, because you go uptown and you're midtown. Everything south of 14th Street is suddenly the village, Greenwich Village, or the East Village, or the Lower East Side. There's a sudden cultural shift when he crossed the street. And I noticed all of these different things, all of these vivid details all around me. And it's been a nonstop source of inspiration all this time. I never have any hang up. Like, what am I gonna draw next? What is the next picture going to be? It's more about, can I focus down on just one at a time? Because I got a whole backlog of images, you know, things that I saw and experienced in that neighborhood that are just patiently waiting online, waiting to come out.
Mm. Tell us a little bit more about what motivated you to start posting your artwork in the streets of New York as a teenager.
the poster art, which, you know, in a way, the street art is the thing that's closest to me, even though I never make a penny from it. You know, who's going to pay you for doing street art? And yet I feel like when I'm posting images on the street, I'm communicating directly with the people, with my people, that is the public, a cross section of New York City, like we were talking about earlier, all the different kinds of people who are in the city are going to see something. If you post it on the street and it doesn't get spray painted over, you know, within the first hour or two, if it stays up overnight and it's in a busy intersection, it means that hundreds of people will have seen it. That is, you will have communicated with hundreds of people, thousands of people, if the thing stays up for a few days. In my case, it's usually street posters. I wasn't really that much of a graffiti writer. I never considered myself a writer. I had friends who did that and went out with the spray cans at night. I did it on occasion. And I always made a point of having a big old black magic marker in my pocket. Yeah, I still do, because you never know when, you know, you may be out waiting at a subway station and you might see some billboard that is in need of some improvement or correction. But what I started doing as a teenager was just drawing on, you know, pen on paper and then printing them up and putting up, they weren't even really posters at first because they were too small to be called posters, just 8.5 by 11 pieces of paper, taping them up or gluing them up on the street or just, you know, tacking them up on a bulletin board. And I realized that this was an extremely direct method of communication. And whether it was a picture or a combination of imagery and words, you could be as provocative as you want to be, right? People might even disagree with you. People might get really angry and have a violent reaction at what you're expressing. But what I learned early on was, yes, they might have an extremely violent reaction and just rip the poster right down off the wall and tear it up into 1,000 little pieces. But meanwhile, you're already safe across town. Right? They could tear up your picture. That's okay, because you printed up hundreds of them or thousands of them. But meanwhile, your ass is safe back at home making the next batch of posters. So that was a strategy I learned early on, the hit and run aspect of it.
Mm. You know, Eric, in listening to you, I was never blessed with the gifts to throw up or to throw up art, if you will. But I did understand the message, and I did have friends growing up in New York City who were talented that way. And yes, this was a political response. It was a stand of social justice, and many times it started out like just throwing your name to be popular. But then you guys changed that and made that landscape come to life, where messages, as you just shared, from areas of need or things that we didn't agree with, were starting to become prominent. So there's a lot of political aspect to that. And thank you for blessing us for the years of that, because now your legacy stays in some way, somehow. There might be a poster there somehow, if the weather permitted, that is still there, rocking your colors. Can you tell me a little bit about growing up in New York City? What was your influence to kind of get this artistic style with this political voice? Because as you just mentioned, you were putting up posters, and this hit and run became not only a tactic, it became a message that you were laying out for us. Can you tell me more?
Well, there was something inherently democratic about just printing up anything, as opposed to just having one original or a painting that's going to be just on the wall of one person's house, usually a wealthy person's house, because who else can afford to buy original art, mm-hmm. right? But if you make multiple copies of it, a dozen, 50, 100 copies of it, and then you could distribute them cheaply. There's something inherently democratic about that, that everyone gets to see it. Everyone can afford a print, maybe just a signed print, or you don't even have to sign it, right? Mm-hmm. I just love the fact that we have, you know, we're in this industrial era, this technological age. So one of the things we could take advantage of, rather than being taken advantage of, is that we could make multiple copies of imagery or, you know, or text or poetry, what have you, that's important to us. Right, 99% of the time, it's moving in the other direction. We're just kind of seen as a captive audience. We're standing there at the train station, so there are all these billboards that are aimed at us. We're in a precarious situation now if we're allowing corporations to be putting up the billboards on the side of highways and the subways and the bus shelters and all of these places. Mm-hmm. But if we're not also participating, if we're not also putting our work up in public places, you know, but only keeping it in our private sketchbooks or trying to, you know, make it into a gallery show, you know, someday, if we're going to keep our sights as low as that, we're not going to be communicating with the people who, you know, who we have most in common with. I'm always a little surprised that the big corporations seem to be much hipper than us in that way. Like they get it. They know that the important place to have the work isn't in some little storefront gallery or art museum, but it's right out on the street in mm-hmm. public. That's where you're having the big impact. If you want to be not just expressing your emotions and your art and your music and your beauty, but maybe you have specific ideas that you're trying to communicate, or a certain, maybe you want to offer a critique of society or of the economy, or even if it's just the local economy.
You know, you remind me of something. You know, when kids are playing in their neighborhoods, and they're drawing pictures of rainbows and putting their names around their families, and they're using chalk in the street to kind of illustrate, funny enough, how these grabbers work directly with the family and parents. Say, wow, how pretty is this? And the child is able to showcase their work. But you may not think, but know this, many times when people are out trying to buy property or trying to look for homes, they look for things like this. And if a neighborhood has children who like to draw in the street, it may seem safe. It may seem a place that's appealing. And it's funny how these things work out. Just as you mentioned, the arts are so great in making sure that we are listening and looking at all times. I wanted to ask you, as you were putting together, you have this trilogy that we're going to talk more about your book. But can you tell me a little bit about your creative process when it comes to working on a new illustration or maybe even one of your novels? What is your thought process as you're trying to create? How does this come for you?
The process. It's a good question. You know, do I even have a single process? It feels like anytime I'm working on a project or a different picture or a book project, it always seems to come about in a different way. Sometimes the pictures come first, sometimes the words come first. I don't know if I've observed a pattern with that, where I have a certain method. Mm-hmm. I'm sure many people do. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I do. You know, sometimes I try to be very organized and just write an outline first and then develop it, you know, one step at a time. Mm-hmm. But I think, to be honest, I think most of my, you know, the things that I crank out each day just have to kind of take on a life of their own. Mm. I suppose all of them start out with an idea. I guess you could say that. There's some kind of concept behind mm-hmm. it, even if the concept is just a visual one, something about, I'll just riff on the idea that I'm working on right now. It's it's kind of embarrassing because it's so abstract. And I pride myself that I'm not an one of those abstract artists. My work is very concrete. Mm-hmm. It's about specific things in the real world. And yet the image that I'm playing around with now is really in a nebulous state. It's very out of focus. It's very abstract, but it's a nighttime scene. This is going to be a painting, right? Which will end up being either a magazine cover or a CD, you know, an album cover or something. I'm not even sure. And I try not to even get too hung up about where it's going to end up.
Mm.
Aside from the fact that most of my work ends up being printed, you know, I love the fact that I'm making multiple copies of it. It's not just a single painting. And if it is a painting, I end up printing it. It ends up being somewhere in the media, the mass media. So this is a good example to answer your question. How does my process unfold? It's a nighttime scene. It's a vertical image, that is, it's upright, vertical rather than horizontal, like a landscape typically is. But New York, everything seems to be concentrated in just a few square miles, and everything is going straight up. So I want to include that in this image, and I want the image to partly be about that, just about verticality itself. Okay. Again, I feel a little embarrassed talking about it in such abstract terms like this. Like it's almost like art for art's sake, and yet I want the finished image to really have more of a to be about something, to be about city. You're in the city at night, and maybe it's raining. I want everything to be shiny, so that maybe there's a street light, maybe there's a neon sign in the store across the street, which means that directly below it, if it's raining and there are puddles on the street, it's going to be reflected. The lights are going to be reflected. Everything's going to be duplicated below, which already, you know, there's already some automatic poetry going on there where everything is reflected, but it's still fairly abstract. The part of the picture that I haven't really solved yet is, it sounds like a very pretty picture, Eric, but what's it about? What does it really mean?
Mm.
Of course, it doesn't have to have anything. It could just be a pretty image of the street at night that puts you in a certain mood, you know, like a piece of instrumental music does. There's certainly nothing wrong with that, listening to some Miles Davis or someone like that. But to me, the lyrics are really important. I love songs that have really poignant lyrics and that are about something and that are kind of challenging you in different ways. So this is a part of the process. It's all kind of coming together. It's coming into focus. This image I'm talking about is a city image, as most of my images are about the city, but it's nighttime, it's raining, everything is shiny, the lights are reflecting in the puddles, but I still don't know yet what the central focal point is going to be. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking it should probably be a human being, someone, some shadowy figure stepping, crossing the street, or maybe they're walking their dog. Or maybe it's just maybe there is no person. Maybe it's just a couple of dogs walking through the city at night, and that would be a story in itself. What are these dogs, you know, without a leash? What's happening? Maybe it's a pack of dogs, or maybe it's some other animal. Maybe it's some kind of elephant or an animal that you would never see in New York City at night. And what would that be saying? Go ahead.
Thank you for letting us in, because I've had various artists on my show and I've listened to the answer and it's almost just about the same. There is no process. There is something that happens. And I'm glad that you brought in songwriting or even music, that it starts one way, may end up another. You really don't know. Sometimes you have the words first, music last, bed first, hook last. but it turns out to be something that speaks to you. And I think that that's where our listeners are going to benefit of your open-mindedness, of your ability to let ideas just continue to stem and go through your mind and then let your hand and heart kind of like do the talking at the same time. I want to talk a little bit about you've done so much work, but let's start talking a little bit about Flood. How did you approach to tell us a story without words? And this was a very beautiful book, by the way.
Thanks. Yeah, and it was my first book. It was a graphic novel, came out a couple of decades back. We weren't really using that terminology then, graphic novel. Mm-hmm. In fact, it was a bit of a conundrum for bookstores. They didn't know how to categorize it. You know, where are they going to put it in the store? They did. Now, if you go into a hip independent bookstore, they'll have a whole section of graphic novels. You know, the poetry section is over there, history there, and then graphic novels is one of the growing parts of in the publishing world. Even if you go into a library now, they'll have a whole graphic novel department. Mm-hmm. But they didn't have that word back then, or it hadn't really caught on yet when I published Flood. But it was a purely graphic novel. That is, there were no words at all in the first book. It was kind of an experiment, a little bit like a comic book. There are panels, you know, arranged sequentially. So you're looking at the pictures from left to right, like you would do if you were reading words, except that there are no words. It's just a series of pictures. You know, maybe 4, 5, 6 pictures on a page. You turn the page, and there's another half a dozen images, panels. But they're all of them can be read because all of them are very concrete. They're recognizable shapes and images. They're none of that abstract kind of artsy fartsy stuff you see in the art museums. Mm-hmm. I wanted to tell a specific story that people, you know, would be able to understand. And I feel like I'm communicating a story and certain ideas through the story. So it was like many first novels, it was largely autobiographical. About this young man, young artist, young cartoonist in his 20s, his early 20s, who lives there and on the Lower East Side, and he comes home one night. It's a dark and rainy night. Hey, that seems to be a theme in my work, rain. In the newest book, it snows a lot. So it's a variation on a theme. But I guess what is snow but frozen rain, right? Mm-hmm. I like playing around with the different atmospheric effects because although it's superficial, right, it's no substitute for telling a story, it just kind of gives another layer. There's another dimension. It creates more of a mood. The same way you tell a story, is it daytime? Is it nighttime? Is it a cloudy day? Mm-hmm. These are all things that the reader usually isn't even that conscious of. They're just following the story, following the characters in the story, following the human element. And yet you, as the writer or the artist, you're also creating a certain mood that the reader is definitely picking up on it. Unconsciously, you know, that you're putting them in this kind of vulnerable mood. And then the way that Flood winds up, by the last few pages, it starts raining really, really hard. And it's raining in earnest now. It's like thunder and lightning, and it's raining so hard, and it's not stopping. And that the artist's studio, as he's there at the drawing board, and there's a growing puddle at his feet. And by the end, it's up to his knees, up to his waist. But he keeps drawing. He keeps drawing the story, which ends up being the very story that we're reading. And the room just fills up with water, and that he's underwater, and yet he's still there at the drawing board underwater. Mm-hmm. And he manages to escape through a window at the last moment while he's there holding his breath. And he's floating through the city at night, and it's this impossible city landscape, like the flood. What would New York look like if there was a great biblical flood? Manhattan, right? You've probably had this dream. I think this is the dream of all native New Yorkers of what would New York look like? Not just in some corny disaster movie where something is blowing up or they smash a build, a couple of trade towers get knocked down. What would New York look like if the entire city, Manhattan, the Bronx, Queens, Brooklyn, the whole thing was underwater? And there were only a few buildings peeking up like the tip of the iceberg. You would see the very tip of the MetLife building, or the very top of the Empire State Building or the Chrysler Building. Mm-hmm. What would that look like? There's only one way to find out, and that's to draw or paint a picture of it. So that's how that story, that whole book, evolved with really that recurring dream that I was having from childhood of being out at sea, being underwater, and yet I'm still there in the city. It just the everything is now underwater.
It's interesting because for some of us, they may not catch on into the pictures about rain or snow, but that was what drew me first, because emotions and weather have this combination of how they link together. And in your new book, there's some snow, and we're going to talk about that. But in flood, there's water in abundance.
That's and right. What it's is, right there in the title. Yes.
Yeah. So how is it? And for me, that was important, because there's many of us who are dealing sometimes with depression. Sometimes we are dealing with a challenge and we have to overcome that. And I've noticed that in your technique, your characters have to overcome challenges. Mm. And weather just part of it, but it's the story of it all. Such a beautiful piece, and you got awards for it. It's something to even see. I mean, greatly, greatly, greatly done.
Well, all of these elements, as you know, as the your listeners, all of the poets out there listening, you already know this, that the elements, you know, water, fire, ice, just by mentioning these and rhyming with other words in your poetry or your writing, it has an emotional effect on the reader. I mean, not only does it change the mood, but I mean, it could be a very overwhelming emotion. You have a certain control over the reader, or you know, the listener to the song, by using these elements, this elemental language. But it could be a painting, and it could have the elements of the snow or the wind. You know, the wind is blowing so hard, the trees are getting knocked over, right? And there's the symbolism of all these things, right? Water, rain in a poem or in a story or in a book, in the case of flood. Yeah, it's about a rainy day, but it's more than that. It's also what is this symbol of? What does the rain represent? It's the mood of the character, the protagonist. Mm-hmm. It's a manifestation of the mood that he's in or that she's in that day, or she feels like she's overwhelmed by the events unfolding in her life, and she feels like she's drowning. We all relate to that. These are universal. Emotions are universal. Feeling like we're drowning. We just can't even, we don't even know what we're going to do. We're so overwhelmed. So that's the other thing that all the poets and writers and artists in the audience have already discovered, is that this is all the raw material. These are all the instruments, the tools that we have in our box to not, you know, not only tell a story with a beginning, middle, and an end, but create a whole universe that has a mood and an emotion and a sense of urgency, and all of these things go into the mix.
So now flood is a hit, and then you come right back, and then you drop Blood Song. which is being adapted for a motion picture. Can you tell us what film, if
yeah, possible? It's being made into a feature film right now as we speak in Bangkok, of all places. They're inviting me. They say when it's finished, they're gonna fly me out there. I feel like I'm overdue. I've never visited Asia, much less Southeast Asia. I was a little too old to get drafted and get sent to Vietnam, like some older friends of mine. So I didn't make that scene. But film is being made in Thailand, which is so amazing to me because the story that is based on Blood Song, which was my second graphic novel, like Flood, it's also purely visual. I decided that I wasn't going to have any word balloons or thought bubbles or captions or anything like that. It was going to be using purely visual means, just a sequence of images to tell the story. And part of it was just the fact that I always felt that this was my native tongue. Pictures of my native tongue. When I was young, I would draw pictures. This is before I learned how to read and write. I was already drawing pictures with markers and with crayons and things like that. And it occurred to me that even as a species of a Homo sapiens, we've been drawing pictures on the walls of caves far longer than we've been using language. Especially writing things down. I think the invention of the alphabet, which is a form of technology after all, is pretty new. It's just been in these last few thousand years that we came up with these different symbols like hieroglyphs or Sanskrit, these things that evolved into written language. We've only been using in the last 5,000 years or so, give or take. And yet we've been drawing pictures on rock, on petroglyphs and on the walls of caves all around the planet for 30, 40,000 years. So as individuals, we all recapitulate the process. We start out visual, we're all drawing pictures. I maintain that all kids are natural artists. Like any 2 or 3 year old, you just have crayons lying around. Not only are they going to be able to draw pictures very spontaneously, and they're not hung up or getting self-conscious or anything, they are very natural. I think children have a natural sense of composition, even if it's purely abstract. It's going to be there's going to be a strong composition there, which I think is the most important part of a picture. If the composition is really strong and dynamic, it almost doesn't matter how accurate the anatomy is or anything is, because the abstract composition is so powerful that it's already grabbing you all by itself. So Flood and then Blood Song were purely visual. And I also told myself, well, okay, is this just a dodge? Are you just like afraid to be using words? You're too self-conscious to be using language and word balloons and thought balloons and captions? Why limit yourself to images? And my rationale at first was, well, in New York City, there are so many different languages spoken. What language am I going to write? Is it going to be in Spanish, or is it going to be in English, or in Italian, or in Yiddish, or in Russian, or Korean, or Tagalog, or any of the dozens of languages spoken here in New York? And that's when it occurred to me that if I just left verbal language out of the picture and just was communicating with a sequence of images, that it would automatically be a universal tale that anyone would be able to follow, whatever language they spoke. It doesn't matter if you don't know Russian or you don't know Mandarin Chinese, because you could understand what the pictures are about. That is, if the pictures are drawn clearly enough and they're not too abstract, you could follow the different characters, and you could you could follow the story as it unfolds. And Blood Song ended up being over 300 pages long without any word, you know, not a syllable. There's not even one syllable in the whole story. So the film that's being made now, it's being made by someone who hardly speaks English at all. When I communicate with the director, he speaks to me in broken English. And yet he understands the story inside and out because it's a picture story. So he's able to adapt it to the screen to be a feature film. He's going to have music go. The music is going to be real important in lieu of words. If there are no words at all and no dialogue at all, then the music is that much more important to help communicate the story and to help create a mood. But after these first two stories, I thought, well, I think I've explored this about as far as I can go. I've done two entire books told in pictures. Maybe the next book I can use a few words. It doesn't have to be that many. I could have every few pages there could be a caption or maybe a thought balloon. You at least get to hear what the character is thinking about. And there's no law that says I can't have words. That was only this rule that I was imposing on myself for the last couple of books.
That's interesting, Eric, because before we get to talking about your book, you laid out for us the importance of communicating through pictures, and you touched on students. I know that students with special education often use visuals to kind of understand the sequence of what's happening. I also know that many learners read and connect with academics a lot easier at a higher rate based on what they see. They don't really comprehend what someone is saying to them because it becomes too much information, but they can connect with the visual. And that's why we got a lot of students who either get text-to-speech or speech-to-text and get these accommodations to kind of support. So within your work in these two books, you really spoke to the world in a universal language that touched and reached so many parts of the world. And I don't know if that was the plan, but I know that you did that, understanding that. But now let's get into Naked City, which, as you just mentioned, you said, I said a few words. I didn't say none before. How difficult was it for you to put together such a beautiful story? And we'll talk more about this story, but to tell us a story and draw it out as well. How difficult was that?
We'll use the word challenging. Let's just say that. I found it to be extremely challenging. But I gave myself a lot of time. I find that if you don't have the time constraint and you're going to just like allow a project to take as much time as it needs to, then you could relax a little bit. You know, you don't have that other, you know, little character on your shoulder telling you faster, faster. When are you going to finish? You know, there's a deadline. If you just are able to silence that voice and say, well, I'll finish this book, when it's finished. Maybe it'll take 2 years. Maybe it'll take 8 years, but exactly. I'm not going to get hung up with that this time. Just as an experiment. Just to see, it may be a total disaster. I mean, if you spend too much time with it, the whole world passes you by, or you finish the book and it ends up on the bestseller list and makes all this money, but you're an old man by the time it's published. So you're balancing a lot of different elements, and time is always a big factor. But that was one of the things that I decided early on, is that I was going to just give myself time, as much time as I needed, because this is the first book that I'm using a lot of words and dialogue, and not just words and dialogue, but there are many, many more characters in this story. Whereas the first couple of books, you were really just following this the protagonist, and they would encounter different situations and different people, but you were really identifying with the one character through the whole, you know, labyrinth of the tale. Naked City, the newest book, hot off the press, but it just hit the stores a couple of months ago, is far more complicated, more complex, that there are many, many stories. There are actually two protagonists. And then each protagonist has lovers and enemies and people that they're dealing with and trying to keep at bay and trying to hold on to. So it has a very different flavor and different texture than the earlier books. Not only does it have dialogue and are the characters actually speaking and using thought balloons where you could even see what they're thinking about, which is one of the things I love about the language of comics, is that in addition to word balloons, you got thought balloons or thought bubbles. Mm-hmm. And you could even play with it. You could have the character saying one thing, but the thought bubble, he's thinking something else, right? And you can't, most art forms don't really allow you to show the discrepancy. Like he's, you know, or she's saying this, but she's thinking the opposite of that. Mm-hmm. And, it, you know, you're reading it instantly in the form of a comic book that everyone, you know, everyone learns the language of comics when they're little kids. So this book is definitely a lot funnier than the other ones, which were real serious. Really, if anything, they were on the tragic tip. Mm-hmm. Flood. I mean, it's about this, you know, apocalyptic flood in the final chapter of the book. The whole city is underwater. There's nothing particularly funny about that. Or at least it wasn't funny at the time while we were all drowning, and mm-hmm. treading water. It wasn't so funny that now we could look back and laugh at it. And Blood Song was also dead serious and had some themes about U.S. Military intervention in places that, well, it looks a little like Vietnam, but we can't be certain. Why? Well, because there are no words at all. All we could see is, well, there are palm trees in the background. Are we in Southeast Asia? Or it could just as easily be Central America somewhere or South America. That's why the movie they're making of Blood Song now, the director picked up on the fact that it looked like Southeast Asia is what I had in mind, even though I didn't specify it. But the book ended up falling into the hands of this young man in Bangkok, and he right away assumed that it was about his landscape, his land of Southeast Asia. So I thought the whole film is being made in Bangkok, where I've never been. The entire cast is people from Thailand. It's all Asian. I think there's the only non-Asian in the entire film is this. There's an African guy, sort of like a black dude who's not even from the U.S. He's from Africa, the saxophone player, mm-hmm. who ends up being the kind of the hero of the story. But I don't want to give it away. A lot of these themes I'm playing with again in Naked City. But as I was starting to say, this time I wanted it to be a comedy. We're living in such difficult times, such bleak and often tragic times right now. There's so much uncertainty, to put it mildly, that I didn't want to create another work of art that was just going to be bleak, existential, tragic Shakespearean tale, the existentialism. No. I've already made that scene several times. I want this one to make people laugh, at least some of the time. I suppose it would be more accurate to call Naked City a tragicomedy, because it's not purely fun. It's kind of a blend of both. It's a serious story, but then the character, one of the protagonists in it is, I draw him in a very cartoony fashion. I mean, he looks like an old-fashioned cartoon character, and he's tripping and falling down. There's even a certain amount of slapstick going on in there. And that's what I was going for, is to try to hit a comic note, which I found to be far more challenging than doing social criticism or tragedy. it's easy to tell a tragedy. You just look out the window and you just report on what you're seeing in your own autobiography, and it's going to be overwhelmingly tragic with a few bright moments here and there. But I found comedy to be far more difficult in this story. One of the reasons it took so long is I realized that humor or comedy, as important as it is, especially New Yorkers and ethnic New Yorkers like us, where it's kind of a survival mechanism. We have to have the ability to laugh at our at the tragic situation. Mm-hmm. So I discovered that comedy is really tragedy, but it's looking at it from a different perspective. You're just looking at it from a slightly different angle, and you're seeing kind of the humor in it, or the absurdity in it. It's just kind of a different version of what could be a very sad and bleak story. But this time, the audience is laughing. The readers are cracking up. And that's what I'm aiming at. I want people to be like wetting their pants, falling on the floor, laughing is what I was going for. I feel like the other books were making people cry. Well, okay, if you're an artist or a poet, you want to be able to have the full range of expression.
And you did this like a wordsmith. Actually, being able to look at the pictures, and now you had thought bubbles, you had conversations, the storyline was just epic. It's just very real in that you have a singer who has no family. She hitchhikes to New York City. She meets someone else who kind of empowers her to trust her own talents. And that person is just there as a coach, a person who she wants to attach to. But that person is just there for that sort of medium. And then there's the painter who goes from landscapes to painting nudes. And then they all learn about different things. They learn about art. They learn about success. They learn about New York, which I thought was so cool about your story. And
It's all set in New York. And the key scenes right in the center, the heart of the story, isn't just New York City, but it's my old neighborhood. It's the East Village, and it's Tompkins Square Park. Mm-hmm. She's sitting on the park bench where she has this revelation. It's specifically Tompkins Square Park. And then the story at the very end, not to give it away, but it ends up, that's the venue in the final chapter. She ends up in Tompkins Square Park once again.
But again, for me, when I looked at it, I was like, this is just a sheer masterpiece. But once again, this is eight years of work. You may have gone through an extensive process of, yeah, I like this. No, I don't. Yeah, let's go this way. Let's go that way. But what you came up with was a real story. Like, we were talking about the protagonist a bit, Izzy, and her ethnic background. And how she lost her family. Because you not only just said, oh, here's a hitchhiker who showed up. You gave us that backstory. And then you were able to go into the second character and then give their story to match theirs. It was just like watching a movie, honestly. I think that you may have not tried that, or that wasn't your option. But once I started looking through, I had to go through the whole book. Because I said, I need to know. I need to see. And every time that I saw... this is how this is going to go. And then all of a sudden, a new character comes in and kind of changes that. How the industry of art changes and demands. And I was thinking about you. I was like, is he talking about himself? Is he talking about just art in general? When you're here and you're busting your tail to create and you think you have a masterpiece and stuff, but that's not what I want. I'd rather have the guy who is cleaning the windows. I don't really want this.
Hmm.
That to me was a lot. Can you tell us more about how these characters, if they did connect with you in any way, and how so?
Well, each of the characters is based on people I know, and really people I've loved, people I would like, very intimate friendships, or just people I encountered over the years who had a deep impact on me and really stayed with me. So Isabel is a composite characters. It's partly me, even though I thought it would be more challenging to have the protagonist be a woman, because I'm already a guy. I already know what it's like to be a guy. I've done stories with the lead hero is a guy. Be more challenging to do it through the eyes of a young woman. Mm. And there are many voices these days saying, well, you can't, that's not legit. What do you mean? Well, because you're a man. You can't, a man could never know what it's like to be a woman. So you shouldn't even do that. You should only write what you know.
Mm.
And I could understand that, and there's some logic there. And it's extremely risky to tell a story through the eyes of someone who you are not, you know, it's not your experience. It's certainly not your autobiography. And yet, but I'm born and raised in New York City. I've known a lot of people. I've been very, very close, very, very intimate with many, many people over the years. I've known many, many women very, very closely, and have heard their stories and empathized with their stories. And I suppose that's the key. If you have the empathy, if an artist really has sincere empathy, then I think there's no reason why that artist, even if he's some white guy in England, can't tell a story about this black guy, Othello, if he's using his empathy. But of course, that's easier said than done, isn't it, right? Empathy is something that's in short supply these days in our culture. It's not something we could take for granted. And yet, I think it's one of the most important things that an artist or any storyteller needs to have, you know, besides being able to string words together and draw pictures. They need to be able to not just understand the human condition, their own human condition and their own experience, but others, the shoes of another person, mm-hmm. especially through the eyes of a person who's different, very different, almost like your polar opposite. I think that's when it gets really interesting to tell a story. That's when it's the most challenging. But of course, that's also when it's the most risky. And most of the time we don't pull it off. One of the characters in Naked City is this is the street dancer, Alex, the street dancer, who Isabel falls in love with kind of head over heels, a little bit too quickly, right? She falls mm-hmm. in love with Alex. Alex, in many ways, seems to be the only character in the story who really knows how to have a good time. And if you notice, I don't know if it jumped out at the readers, but I leave it very vague what Alex's gender.
What do you want our readers to get from Naked City when they do purchase your book? What do you want them to know?
Well, I mean, there's no big, great message that I'm trying to communicate, although there's a few, the story itself points to a few directions that we learn by the final chapter, is that maybe as creative people who are trying to make a living and support ourselves and be successful, what does that word success mean? We have to be very careful with that, because the word success, if we look it up in like an American dictionary, it's going to mean a specific thing, of course. It's going to be economic success. That's obvious. That's what I thought you were talking about.
Mm.
You wanted to be successful, or aren't you talking about the Benjamins? It's all about the Benjamins, isn't it? Well, so that's one of the things that we examine, and the characters in the story learn, each one of them has to learn the hard way, that maybe that's not really what it is to an artist. Maybe there are other things beyond economic success. Maybe there are ways of being, just a way of looking at the world. Or in my case, I feel like economic success is great. It's wonderful if I could pay my landlord every 4 weeks so he doesn't evict me and I have money left over to pay for food and cat food, then that's great. But that's not the main reason I'm doing it. My main measure of success is, am I able to communicate? Am I able to get down onto the paper what I had in my head? Well, am I able even able to do that? Am I able to get it out of my skull, through my hand, onto the paper or onto the canvas? If I'm able to do that, then I was successful.
Eric, before we let you go, the floor is yours. What do you want our listeners to remember about you, your book, your legacy?
Yeah. It's a means of expression, personal expression, but it's also a powerful means of communication. That's one thing that I hope I'm inspiring people to see. Beyond that, I guess right now I've just been fixated on this theme that this naked city is all about. And we learn in the final pages of the book is that as difficult, as grim as things look, as short as the days are, as long as the nights are, and we're always wishing for something. We have these things we wish for and things we're trying to make happen that always seem a little bit out of our reach. But what I've learned is that 9 times out of 10, it's just the way we were looking at it. It's the way that the beauty or what we always wanted or the things that we really needed were right there in front of us all along, and we simply didn't see them. We didn't recognize them. You know, he or she was standing right there, and we didn't recognize who they really meant to us. Or, you know, it just goes beyond the human sphere. It could be animals, trees, just the beauty, the things that we tend to take for granted.
Love that. Sometimes it's not about avoiding the mistakes. It's about making sure that the possibilities of bouncing back with and from them is possible. And those, my friend, are the valuable lessons. Because on this platform it was built, because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. But this is no longer. Our plight and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Tune in, friends, to another He's Just a Social Worker show, coming to another town near you real soon. We're out. Eric, my friend, thank you so much for a lovely show.
Hey, thank you. It's great to be here.
Please note that the views expressed here are my own and not a representation of my employers and clients. Thank you for listening. We're always here for you. Just message us and we'll get back to you within 24 hours. Thank you. More than just at He's Just a Social Worker. In memory of my mother, Matilde De La Rosa, this is dedicated to you, Mom. Miss you so much. En memoria de mi madre, Matilde De La Rosa, esto va dedicado a ti, Mamá. Te extraño mucho.